Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, April 27, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be featuring a preview of tomorrow's oral argument in the gay marriage cases. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our two experts of about 10 minutes or so. Professor Bradley might get a minute or two longer because he's going to be giving us some background on these cases. We'll hear first from Professor Gerard V. Bradley. He's at the University of Notre Dame Law School, and he'll be followed by Professor Ilya Soman. He's at George Mason University School of Law here in Washington. With that, let's get right to the program. Professor Bradley, your opening remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and the Federalist Society as well. I'm very pleased to appear again on Teleforum with Professor Soman. And the topic is the oral argument tomorrow. I should say that perhaps the place to begin is on the first Monday of October of 2014, when the Supreme Court surprised most observers, and certainly surprised this observer, when it declined to review a slew of cases from several states involving same-sex marriage and challenges to traditional state laws limiting marriage to the union of a man and a woman. I think at that time, October 6th of 2014, most observers would have figured that the court was not prepared to take on the same-sex marriage issue and would not take it on this term. But again, another surprise, and certainly to myself, to this observer, came on January 16th of this year, when the Supreme Court decided to grant review, to grant cert, in four same-sex marriage cases, all from the Sixth Circuit, and one from each of the four states in the Sixth Circuit. And as most of our listeners probably know, but just in case some don't, I will say that the court granted review in these four cases from the Sixth Circuit and accepted review for two questions. One was whether the 14th Amendment requires a state to issue a marriage license to two people of the same sex, and or to recognize a marriage between two people of the same sex when their marriage is lawfully licensed in another state or jurisdiction. So those are the two questions, whether states must recognize same-sex marriage and license them within their own borders, and or whether states are obliged by the Constitution, by the 14th Amendment, to recognize same-sex marriage as lawfully performed elsewhere. And it does say in another state or jurisdiction, so that indicates, I think, quite clearly that marriages abroad, same-sex marriages abroad in Canada, for example, would be included within this question. I think the consensus view, and it's the view I share, about how this case will turn out, I'm speaking here purely descriptively and predicting, not my own critical view of what the court should do, but I think it's much more likely than not that the Supreme Court, by and around June 30, will decide both questions in the affirmative, and the court will therefore decide that the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, requires states to recognize and license same-sex marriages. I think there is a microscopic chance, and again, I'm speaking purely predictively here, a microscopic chance that John Roberts would be in a majority in favor of same-sex marriage. But I think it's much, much more likely that the five-member majority in favor of same-sex marriage would include Justice Kennedy, and then you can imagine who the four dissenters would be. Now, as to how the argument will go tomorrow, I must say I lack confidence in my own judgments about what shape the argument will take. The case surely will be well argued on both sides. There's a multitude of amicus briefs filed as well. My guess, and it is no more than that, and I won't dwell on it because it's not much more than a guess, is that the argument tomorrow will prove to be a poor predictor of the shape of any final opinion or set of opinions in this case. My guess is that the argument will be useful to the justices tomorrow to sound out some points or possible lines of arguments that one or the other or perhaps several of the justices are considering, but that it will take the next couple of months or so for the justices to sort through, prioritize, and critically put together and assemble opinions. So I do think the argument tomorrow, while enlightening in its own way, will probably not shed too much light on the form of a final set of opinions. Now, I think the argument of the states, Sixth Circuit states, especially the argument by John Birch out of Grand Rapids, is probably the way to go. I think he'll do a very good job arguing the case tomorrow, John Birch will, and I think his focus, like so many others' focus, will be on Justice Kennedy. And I think he's probably adopted the line of attack, if you will, that is the most promising one, and that is to try to get Justice Kennedy, indeed the whole court, but let's speak frankly about the swing vote, to get Justice Kennedy to think of the issues as a lawyer could and should, that is to say, to think about what kind of law the court will be making if it should take the view that it wants to recognize or require states to recognize same-sex marriage. And again, I would describe this line of attack as trying to get the court to think like lawyers, not as rhetoricians, not as political philosophers, and not even as moralists, but rather to think as lawyers. And I think that with Justice Kennedy in particular, there is some hope, although I think it's not a it's a faint hope, but there is some hope that Justice Kennedy could be persuaded, perhaps in light of the now emerging and perhaps already obvious toll that same-sex marriage will take upon religious liberty and upon the ability or capacity of religious persons and religious institutions to participate in public life. It's possible that Justice Kennedy, who cares deeply about religious liberty, will see the likely costs that same-sex marriage will impose upon religious liberty, conclude that the democratic process is the better way to work out a decent compromise between same-sex marriage and religious liberty, and perhaps conclude that the court ought not to jumpstart a conclusion or interject itself in this emerging debate. I think that that's the best line of argument for Justice Kennedy. I think it has a chance of succeeding, but it probably will not succeed. So I do think the court, if it should decide in favor of same-sex marriage, will likely reject invitations to declare sexual orientation a suspect class. I think also the court won't rely so much upon the notion of marriage or the opportunity to marry as a fundamental right, but rather will adopt some form of rational basis scrutiny here, and to perhaps apply a rational basis scrutiny to the state's marriage laws. But it would be a scrutiny with some bite. And I think there that the observer, when we see the opinions in late June, we should look very carefully to see exactly what the court is saying and what kind of rational basis test has been employed by the court. And I think we will discover that the court, at least for this occasion, has refashioned and perhaps even invented a new version of the rational basis test. Now, I should say also that the strength, if you will, of the state's argument, again, to invite, try to cause Justice Kennedy to think like a lawyer is its weakness, because that approach to this issue, high stakes and morally significant issue, lacks the drama and the cogency or the compelling quality of arguments that are based in notions of justice, equality, and dignity. Surrounding those notions is a rhetoric of humiliation and demeaning and insult and offense, and that complex of ideas, both the rhetoric of insult, humiliation, and demeaning, and then the substantive ideas of equality and dignity that suffuse these cases, that is the cases in the area of same-sex marriage, that obviously has a much more compelling quality to them, and in that respect is appealing. And certainly it would seem from Roe versus Evans all the way up to 2 years ago in Windsor versus United States that Justice Kennedy has perhaps even backed himself into a corner. He has been beguiled by this sort of argument, the high rhetorical drama, you might even say the political theater of it, and has employed on more than one of these occasions this notion that animus stands behind laws restricting marriage or in other respects restricting some other alleged rights of gays and lesbians. And I think that therefore the smart money really should be on Justice Kennedy continuing to sort of travel this same path of political morality notions of justice and high, that is, dramatic rhetoric. And therefore, I do think that the outcome in late June will be to decide the two questions in favor of those proposing and urging the court to adopt the law in favor of same-sex marriage. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dean and Professor Solomon.
Professor Solomon, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you. I'd like to start by thanking the Federalist Society for organizing this forum, Professor Bradley for participating, and all of you for listening in. In my remarks, I'm going to briefly go over what I count as five different arguments that have been offered for a right to same-sex marriage, and then I'll devote perhaps the bulk of my time to talking about one that I've been involved in, the sex discrimination argument, which is the focus of an amicus brief I've co-authored and filed on behalf of several other legal scholars from different sides of the political spectrum. I tend to agree with Professor Bradley that it's very likely that the Supreme Court will strike down these laws, but there's at least five different paths by which they can do so, and it makes some difference which one they choose. It is even possible that you'll see a divided majority with some justices choosing one approach and other justices choosing another one. The first and perhaps most obvious path is one which says that these laws fail even minimal rational basis scrutiny, the most minimal scrutiny applied to a wide range of laws. I think this is not a very powerful argument, but some lower courts have endorsed it. The second and I think more likely path would build on precedents like Romer and Windsor and would say that here the rational basis scrutiny has to be somewhat stricter than it normally is because this is a case involving animus, that the laws in question are motivated by animus or hostility towards gays and lesbians. A third possibility is one which says that laws that discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation should get some sort of heightened scrutiny, for example, intermediate scrutiny like that applied to sex discrimination, or even strict scrutiny as applied to racial discrimination. A fourth path might be to say that this is not really about discrimination as such. It's about the fundamental right to marriage, which the court has recognized in a number of cases, and laws that violate a fundamental right or impinge on it automatically get strict scrutiny. So that might be a path to striking down this law as well. A fifth argument, one that in my view has not gotten as much attention as it deserves, though it has been endorsed by several lower court judges, is the claim that this is sex discrimination and it should be struck down on the same basis as other laws that discriminate on the basis of gender. And this is what I'll devote most of the rest of my time to. I'll first start out by telling you about why this is sex discrimination, and the answer actually is fairly simple. Imagine three people, Anne, Bob, and Charles. Anne is allowed to marry Bob if she wants to, but Charles is not, even though the only difference between Anne and Charles is that one of them is a woman and the other is a man. So in this case, the legal rights they have or do not have are dependent on their gender, and if your legal right is dependent on your gender, that is the very essence of sex discrimination. And the Supreme Court has long held for many decades that laws that discriminate on the basis of gender must be subject to heightened intermediate scrutiny, which these sorts of laws almost certainly can't meet. Now, one objection is often offered is that these laws can't be sex discrimination because they're not motivated by animus towards a particular gender, whether women or men. However, the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that laws that on their face discriminate on base of sex must be subject to heightened scrutiny, regardless of their motive. Indeed, that rule was first established in a case called Craig versus Boren, which struck down an Oklahoma law which said that men, but not women, are forbidden to purchase 3.2% beer until the age of 21. Nobody imagined that the Oklahoma legislature was motivated by hatred of men or desire to subordinate men to women, yet nonetheless heightened scrutiny was applied, and the law was struck down. A second objection that is often made is the claim, well, these laws actually treat men and women completely equally. Men are forbidden to marry other men, just as women are forbidden to marry other women, so it's all actually symmetrical. The problem with this argument is that it's exactly the same argument that was rejected by the Supreme Court in the interracial marriage area. There, too, the states had said, we're not discriminating on the basis of race. Blacks are forbidden to marry whites, but whites are equally forbidden to marry blacks. And the court said, no, that's still racial discrimination because of the fact that who you can marry still depends on your race. And when the scope of your legal rights depends on what race you are, then that's racial discrimination. And similarly, in this area, when your rights depend on what sex you are, it's sex discrimination. So under current doctrine, this means that heightened scrutiny would apply. We can talk about exactly what that means in questions if people are interested, but I think it's very unlikely these laws could pass that sort of heightened scrutiny. Now, many people argue that if you're an originalist, you must accept laws that ban same-sex marriage. After all, back in 1868, nobody expected that the 14th Amendment would strike down such laws. However, the sex discrimination argument, I think, casts a lot of doubt on the originalist case against same-sex marriage because, as recent scholarship has shown, sex discrimination was actually widely understood to be covered by the amendment at the time. Steve Calabresi, a co-founder of the Federalist Society, has an excellent argument, an article discussing this in the Texas Law Review. He, too, has filed an amicus brief in the case supporting same-sex marriage, albeit his argument is somewhat differently structured from mine. So at the time, it was widely understood that sex discrimination is covered, but they also believed that most forms of sex discrimination then currently extant would be upheld because they thought that they were based on objective factual differences between men and women rather than on an arbitrary desire to oppress or arbitrary discrimination of some sort. However, as most originalists today recognize, the specific expectations of people at the time are not the same thing as the original meaning of the text or the principles that it enacts. If the original expectations were what governed, then we would still have to uphold laws banning interracial marriage, laws excluding women from different occupations, such as the legal profession, and many other laws that today almost everybody, including most originalists, would agree are unconstitutional. What originalism actually means is that we must apply the text and the principles it expresses, but we must also take account of new factual evidence and new societal evidence and the like. Otherwise, we would actually be unable to apply the originalist principles effectively under changing conditions. So what has changed over time? I think what has changed is that in the 1860s and 70s, nobody even imagined that same-sex relationships can fulfill the functions that are usually carried out by opposite-sex ones, such as raising a family, facilitating social ties, strengthening the economic foundations of the family, and many other functions traditionally associated with marriage. But over the last several decades, we've realized that same-sex couples, in fact, can do these things. They can raise children, they can promote sexual fidelity, they can strengthen social ties in a community, and so on and so forth. Similarly, in the same way, we've realized that women actually can engage effectively in many occupations that in the 19th century, most people thought they could not. So today, we would strike down laws banning women from the legal profession and other professions, even though in the 1860s and 70s, most people thought that such laws should be upheld because they were based on objective factual differences between men and women. Now, many people have said, well, there's one thing that opposite-sex couples can do, but same-sex ones cannot, and that is produce children by biological means. This is true, but the institution of marriage has never been limited to this sort of function, not even close. For centuries, people have recognized that the institution of marriage is also there to promote the raising of adoptive children, to promote sexual fidelity, strengthen social ties, provide economic support for family members. None of these are new ideas invented by the same-sex marriage movement or by 1960s hippies. They all date back all the way to the ancient world, the Greeks, the Romans, the ancient Israelites, and so forth. So a state could potentially say that they want to limit marriage to only those couples that can reproduce biologically, but that would mean excluding people who are sterile, people who are elderly, many same-sex couples that have no intention of producing biological children, opposite-sex couples as well. In reality, all of these couples are included because the line that the state has drawn is not based on biological childbearing. It is, in fact, based on sex, and that's what makes it unconstitutional. So I think I'll stop there, and I very much look forward to the rest of the discussion.
Very good. We want to get to audience questions as soon as possible, but I do want to give each of you a chance to respond one to the other. So for a minute or two or three, let's revert to Professor Bradley.
Oh, thanks, Dean. Well, I confess I'm among the group of simpletons who find appealing the argument against Professor Solomon's view that this is a matter of sex discrimination. I find appealing and persuasive the view that it's not sex discrimination precisely because the law applies to men and women equally. Now, I do think that in the end, it doesn't much matter whether I find it appealing or not, because I think the argument that this is sex discrimination, that traditional marriage law is a sex discrimination, probably is question begging. Even if we grant it for sake of argument that it's sex discrimination, presumably sex discrimination can here, as elsewhere, be justified if it serves an important, compelling interest and it's substantially related to that interest. And I think that the answer to that question, let's call it intermediate review question, would surely be yes. That is, traditional marriage laws are justified according to intermediate review if marriage really is the union of a man and a woman. So my point is that the question circles back around to the nature and essential composition of marriage. And what's question begging, I think, in Professor Solomon's approach, is that he assumes or takes for granted that traditional marriage laws, really are kind of functional or have a set of purposes, that there are many ends in view, and that as I understand his description of those ends are really gender neutral, that marriage and marriage laws have served a variety of social purposes. And it may well be true that many of those purposes could be served by same-sex couples. But I think that's not the strong argument of supporters of traditional marriage laws, which is that marriage itself has a certain composition and there's a real thing there. It has a certain nature, has some essential properties. And even if it also has social functions or social effects and can be kind of compromised or conscripted into the law's purposes, there's nonetheless some essential features. And marriage or anything else can have more than one essential feature. So it's not a matter of whether procreation or sexual complementarity has always been the purpose or the overriding purpose of marriage laws, as some apologists for same-sex marriage describe the question. It's just really a matter of whether, among other things, there's an essential quality of marriage, which has to do with the male-female couple. I don't think the comparison to loving really works at all, frankly. I think if we went back and looked at all the briefs and read deeply into the history of the Loving case, we would discover that it was never really about the nature of marriage. I don't think anybody in those days, or even well before that, doubted that Black folks and white folks could marry. Everybody realized marriage was the kind of thing that persons, if it's a man and a woman, could enter into no matter what their skin color. And the opposition to interracial marriage was surely based in racism, that these were marriages that could occur. I mean, there was nothing essential to marriage that would be violated by an interracial marriage, but the state ought to prohibit these marriages. I think especially, not only, but I think even mainly, because of opposition to interracial children that would be the fruit of the union. And that's all rightly condemned by the Supreme Court in the Loving case. But again, the Loving case had nothing to do with the nature of marriage, which I think is the question at hand.
Professor Solomon, you want to take a bit of time
sure.
to respond?
So I'd like to briefly address two issues. One is the essential nature of marriage. The second is the question of religious liberty. I think to talk about the essential nature of marriage misses the point that this is not about a philosophical definition of marriage or a moral definition, but rather about what the state can or cannot do in its state law and what sort of institutions it can attach rights and privileges to. You can say, well, marriage just is a particular way, but I don't think that argument can really work. If it's an argument about what people historically have thought, then historically they have also thought for many centuries that marriage is essentially an institution where it must be between people who have the same religion. They also thought that it's an institution where it must be the case that the husband dominates over the wife and controls all or most of her legal rights. But it turns out that we can have marriage without those attributes, and the same thing is true with respect to whether marriage can have two opposite sex partners or rather same sex partners, that it turns out that it is certainly the case that the state can have a law which says that there is an institution of marriage which is open to people of both sexes, regardless of the sex of the person that they want to marry, and therefore a law which does not do that constitutes sex discrimination, just as the law that was struck down in Loving constituted race discrimination, even though in that case the states had said, well, this law applies to whites and blacks equally, they're both restricted in the same way. It was still race discrimination because the legal rights of the people involved were determined by their race, and similarly in this case it's sex discrimination because the legal rights in question are determined by sex. One can have a philosophical or a definitional view of marriage that requires that it be people of the same faith or people of the same race, or in this case people of opposite sexes, but if the state decides to endorse any of those views, it would be discriminating on the basis of religion or race or sex, and no purely semantic definitional argument can get around that fact. Now lastly, very briefly on the question of religious liberty, I think this is an issue where Professor Bradley and I probably have some common concerns. I think it is indeed very unfortunate that some advocates of same-sex marriage, many of them, want to impose on religious organizations and other private organizations who don't share their views. But I think the way to fight that is through laws like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, also through working to get the Supreme Court to overrule its badly misguided Smith decision. And I think that the way to go here is that the cause of those of us who support religious liberty will be stronger if people don't perceive it simply as a pretext for opposing same-sex marriage in general or for opposing equality for gays and lesbians. If it really is about liberty rather than about hostility to this institution or particular groups, then I think we stand a better chance of success.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. When you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to the audience, let's make an announcement here about upcoming calls. This case, of course, being argued tomorrow, and we will have a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time when we'll recap the arguments in the gay marriage cases. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And on Thursday, also at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, another Courthouse Steps Teleforum. This one is on the Glossop case. That's the death penalty drug execution cocktail case. That is Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Today, of course, the gay marriage case preview. We've got three questions pending. If you want to join that queue, push the star button and then the pound button. Let's take our first call.
Hi, Larry Callahan. Enjoyed the call. And I'm from the fine state of California, which always has interesting laws. Which brings my point. Do these both stand or fall together? For those who know me, please don't laugh, but let me use an example. When I was growing up, the drinking ages in states were very, very different. New York was very different than California, and they were allowed to have those ages. And more important to this topic, the age of consent for a man and a woman to be married without parental consent changed from state to state. And if you were in a state that had, a consent age at 17 and another with 21, as far as I know, if you got married in the States with the consent at a lower age, I'm sorry, the right to marry without parental consent in the lower state, that was recognized in another state. But but do both of these ones just have to go together? So, I mean, could they rule in one and not the other? And do all states have to, would then be required to recognize them?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm willing to yield.
I think there's a very big difference between the two issues of recognizing a marriage that of two people and being required to perform that ceremony. That's it in simple terms.
Professor Bradley, you want to go first here?
Yeah, okay. I think I understand the question, and it has to do with the relationship between the two questions presented to the court. I think there are ways to legally distinguish the two questions, and lawyers can make satisfactory distinctions between them. My own judgment is that those distinctions would not hold for long, and maybe any distinction in the upcoming cases would not even be meant to hold for long. And I think the same set of underlying concerns of both the deeper legal nature and also the philosophical nature and you might say normative nature underlie both questions. And some of what I mean by that or those underlying concerns are the ones that we're vetting on this call. So I think the questions are kind of held together at root by the same set of concerns, and any attempt to distinguish the two questions could not last or outlast the short run. So I guess that's a recommendation for the court to resolve both of them in the same way, one way or the other.
Professor Soane.
I very slightly disagree in that I think if the court rules that states must permit same-sex marriages within their own jurisdiction, it necessarily follows that they would have to recognize those contracted elsewhere. The opposite, I think, isn't necessarily true. The court could say that the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution requires states to recognize opposite-sex marriages contracted elsewhere, same-sex marriages contracted elsewhere, but not to perform them itself. And that sort of equilibrium actually did exist in some states during the era when there were some states that forbade interracial marriages, whereas other states permitted them. So I think it is actually not very likely that the court will end up deciding the issue this way, but it's logically possible. And if it ends up that way, it's an equilibrium that could persist for some time, though I would expect, to be honest, even if the states prevail in this case, I think it's very likely that that would just mean that in 10, 15 years or even sooner, their victory in this case would be overruled. It would suffer a fate similar to Bowers versus Hardwick, which in 1986 upheld anti-sodomy laws by a narrow 5-4 margin, but 17 years later, it got overruled. And I think the same thing could well happen here.
Turn to our next caller. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Go ahead, caller. You might have your own telephone muted. If you do, you need to come off mute. Okay, we have a caller from area code 817. If you want to try and ring in again, we're going to try and move to the next caller now.
This is Matt McReynolds, Pacific Justice Institute. Thanks to both of you for a very informative discussion today. My question is, over the last few years, I've seen quite a lot of deconstruction of the state defense of marriage laws by advocates of so-called marriage equality. I have yet to see any substitute definition offered. And so I'm wondering, can we really expect the states to just have to go back again and again and again to the well, try new definitions, get sued over and over again? Or what is a definition that's been out there that maybe I've missed or that maybe Professor Soane would propose that would replace the simple definitions that are being challenged?
Yeah, I think asking for a single, uniquely correct definition of marriage, I think, is not the right way of looking at this case. I think the states can actually define marriage in all sorts of ways if they want to. It's just that whatever mechanism they choose, it shouldn't discriminate on the basis of sex or if the sexual orientation argument prevails, it shouldn't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. However, within that, the states have many options. They can vary the age of consent for marriage. They can vary the number of people that are allowed to participate, whether monogamous or polygamous. They can vary the extent to which close relatives are allowed to marry, whether they permit cousin marriage and so forth. So I don't think that my side of debate, or for that matter, the other side either, is required to come up with a uniquely correct definition of marriage that all states must adhere to. Rather, what I'm saying, and what I think most advocates of same-sex marriage are saying, though admittedly not all, is that the states have a wide range of discretion in choosing how to define marriage, but they simply have to stay away from discriminating on certain particular types of grounds, such as sex, or perhaps also sexual orientation.
Hmm. Professor Bradley, anything on this point?
Yeah, I'm not really sure myself what a uniquely correct definition of marriage would be, but I think the answer to the caller's question has been on display in pretty much any of the appellate cases over the last few years. I mean, every one that I've looked at, and I teach the material every year or so to my students, when the money is on the table, each one of these opinions has a sentence or two or three or four or more, which begins, marriage is. And what follows is a definition of marriage, whether it's uniquely correct, I'm not sure if it matters. But these courts are defining marriage. And what follows is almost always something very close to a long-term sexual relationship or a committed long-term sexual relationship between two persons. Now, I can't imagine what that is offered as by these courts other than as a definition of marriage. And there you go.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. And let me see, while we're waiting to see who else might ring in, let me ask a question of either of you, sort of about the political process here, maybe going back as far as, two things. One, I've seen this court and other Supreme Courts, they're sometimes very deft at avoiding tough questions, sort of kicking things down the road or taking the narrowest view possible. I wonder if there's some way that they might do that here, just to avoid answering this question and maybe just to avoid what some folks on the court might think of as usurping the political process. And I'm thinking back to some of the arguments in the wake of Roe v. Wade, now that the case has some years on it. A lot of folks are arguing that the nation was trending in that direction had the court just put the argument aside, the case aside, I suppose. Things would have allowed to develop more naturally in a national dialogue, a national conversation. You can maybe say the same thing of same-sex marriage in this country. It was at least being discussed. It was moving some ways through the courts more quickly in the direction in favor of same-sex marriage. But is there any likelihood of the court doing anything like that, taking those factors into consideration here?
I think in a sense they already have taken into consideration in that, to some degree, the swing justices on the court, particularly Justice Kennedy, perhaps may have waited until the coast was clear on this issue. That is, until you have national majority public opinion in favor of same-sex marriage and the trend clearly going that way. So if they strike it down now, while there still will be strong opposition in some quarters, it won't be as overwhelming as it would have been, say, 5, 10, 15 years ago. At the same time, I don't think that this would be a decision comparable to the Griswold decision, where they struck down the one state that still forbade married couples to buy contraceptives here. It would still be creating nationwide same-sex marriage significantly earlier than it otherwise would occur. And I think all indications so far at least point to the idea that the court is not going to say, well, this is too dangerous an area for us to wade into. I think the reason why they've taken this case at the particular time that they have most likely is because they really do want to strike down these laws. They could try to do it on a narrow rationale rather than a broad one, on one that has relatively few implications for other cases rather than relatively many. But I think the trend is that they are probably going to strike this down, and that they feel that they wouldn't be taking too big a political risk in doing so.
I agree.
All right, we've got a couple more questions pending now. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi, I'm wondering if there's any long-term consequences that may arise regarding state licensing if this were to be decided on equal protection but under the rational basis test as opposed to intermediate or any other type of scrutiny.
Who wants to go first on that?
I can, or I can defer, whichever you prefer.
Go ahead, Professor Soman.
Sure. So there's two different rational basis arguments that are in play here. One says that this fails even very minimal rational basis scrutiny. And if that argument is accepted, it would be kind of weird because either the case would be treated as sort of an unusual outlier, or it would mean ratcheting up the rational basis test in general for all laws. A second rational basis argument says that normally rational basis is a very low level of scrutiny, but it gets ratcheted up to what scholars call rational basis plus if there's animus involved. And in this case, the animus would be animus against gays and lesbians. I think that would mean effectively that laws discriminated against gays and lesbians would all get a kind of heightened scrutiny in the same way, and it would have implications for other such laws, though there actually aren't very many such laws still on the books. There are still, I think, a few states that forbid adoption by same-sex couples or disfavor it. Those laws would probably be undermined and in danger, but there actually today are relatively few other laws that are on the books. It might have implications for issues of animus with respect to other sorts of groups and for the way the court judges whether animus exists. In general, I'm sort of divided in my own mind on this argument, and I do think there is a lot of animus against gays and lesbians, and it does underlie these laws. At the same time, I have some skepticism on both originalist grounds and other methodological grounds of the court using animus as an analytical category for dealing with cases, because I think it's amorphous and has a number of conceptual problems that we can talk about if others are interested.
Professor Bradley?
Well, you know, I suspect that what I'm going to offer is a bit tangential to the questioner's intentions, but I do think that the use of the term license in this context is itself a bit unstable, or at least the term is ambiguous. And it's straddling an ambiguity in probably in the emerging law of same-sex marriage and maybe even ambiguity in our own discussion today. And it's this, whether we really should be thinking of the state as truly licensing marriages or licensing, that is authorizing and permitting couples to marry, and whether in fact marriage is to be understood itself as a state construction, that it really depends for its existence upon legal activity, and therefore the state would be, in a sense, admitting couples into a legal status, which is entirely a state's creation. And I think that might be the direction in which the law ends up going, at least if Professor Soman's right, that we really should sharply distinguish and separate between the reality of marriage, or what he might call the philosophy of marriage, or a uniquely correct definition of marriage, and civil marriage. The idea here being that civil marriage is really to be taken literally, and that that civil marriage is simply a state creature. Now, this would be a radical, abrupt, and I think highly consequential break from our entire tradition. Our whole tradition of marriage and family law has always presupposed that the couple marries each other, and that the law of marriage supervenes upon a reality of marriage, and that the law was really there to promote and protect and regulate a non-political, non-legal reality. And the law, at least until the day before yesterday, had always drawn into it and depended upon and presupposed what some might call a philosophy of marriage, but I would simply describe as the reality of marriage. And maybe we're going to go in a radically different direction, but I think it's important to note that that is what we would be doing and perhaps are on the verge of doing. That is to say, radically separating the law of marriage from the reality of marriage.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. Let me ask a question on the sort of the rational basis plus test that you've mentioned a couple times now, Professor Soman. And what I've heard throughout these cases, the argument in these cases about the animus. What does the record say about animus, and what evidence is provided? Is that what evidence does the court accept on that? Is the record built below on those points? And especially when it's something like, if it's an act, a state law, I suppose there are dozens of legislatures who voted for it. What does the record look like there? And if it's a referendum or a constitutional amendment where, millions of citizens are voting for or against it, how do they develop a record of animus at that level?
Yeah, so there's several kinds of things in the record and several possible ways to measure animus. One that hasn't been used as much, but that to my mind is the most powerful evidence, is that if you just look at public opinion data, or for that matter, elite opinion on these issues, one of the most powerful predictors of whether you support these laws banning same-sex marriage or not is whether you believe homosexuality in general is immoral. So how you feel about gays and lesbians in general is an extremely powerful predictor of how you feel about same-sex marriage. It trumps almost everything else that you can put into an equation or almost everything else you can find in the data. And I think if we think about a counterfactual world where nobody had any hostility to gays and lesbians generally, but they just based their support or opposition for same-sex marriage based on other considerations, such as whether it would be good for the children or the like, I think in that world there would be overwhelming support for same-sex marriage, not unanimous support, but overwhelming, and we wouldn't have had most, if not all, of these referenda and the like banning it. So that's one sort of measure. It is certainly in the record of some of these cases. However, the Supreme Court, in dealing with past animus cases, to my mind, wrongly, has been very reluctant to look at this kind of actual objective evidence of where the public opinion was. Instead, they tend to focus on such questions as how broad the law is, and whether it seems to be sweeping or not, and sometimes statements in the legislative history, if it's a legislatively enacted law and the like. You do have some evidence, but it's somewhat more ambiguous than the actual evidence of public opinion. That said, however, I think the whole concept of animus in the doctrine is somewhat ill-defined, and therefore the court, if it wanted to, could certainly rule on that basis without having to deviate from the existing precedent too much. As I've said before, I do not particularly like this rationale. I think if the court is going to use it, it should try to base it on actual objective evidence of where the public opinion actually was, but the court, I think for various reasons, doesn't like to look at that sort of evidence.
And if some of the court records below show animus, or they've made a finding of animus, but some of them haven't, are those cases going to be relitigated if the Supreme Court uses that as the basis of its decision? I mean, are states going to come back saying our state was not one in which animus was a factor? Right.
They could try that. But I think the court would, if the court makes an animus-based decision, they will probably try to frame it broadly enough so that you wouldn't end up with sort of factually based litigation with respect to animus. I think one of the possible advantage of the court defining animus in terms of what the law does as opposed to in terms of the public opinion evidence is that these laws are all structured very similarly. So if you reason it that way, then the court, the states couldn't say, well, the polls in our state indicate something different from the polls in another state. I think, this sort of framing shows some of the flaws in the animus doctrine, in that if animus really is about the motivation behind the law, you should look at the actual motives and not merely at sort of the details of what the law does, but sort of this an area of doctrine which I think has not been developed very well, although there are some scholars who argue otherwise, and for those who are interested, there's a recent article by Dale Carpenter of the University of Minnesota called Windsor Products, where he actually does make a valiant effort to try to make sense of this doctrine, though I'm not sure he completely succeeds.
Professor Bradley, you have anything on this point?
Well, just briefly, I think it's very, very unlikely the Supreme Court's going to decide these cases one way or the other on a contingent fact about the people of a particular state, or even a contingent fact about legislators in a particular state. And frankly, I've always myself thought that animus was just an inflammatory way to describe the results of the rational basis test. That is, that the structure of the expression in the cases that I've looked at, including some Supreme Court cases, is basically the following. Having found no rational basis for traditional marriage laws, what could possibly explain them other than a kind of non-cognitive prejudice of some sort? And that's what we call animus. So I don't think animus adds anything to, or perhaps, if you will, subtracts from the rational basis test itself.
We do have a couple questions pending in our audience now, so let's turn back to our listeners.
Professor Soman, this is a question for you, and it actually has to do with something that someone I know you know very well, Professor Josh Blackman, wrote on the issue. And Professor Blackman's thought was that if the court were to give LGBT status heightened security or scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause, that perhaps the rationales for something like same-sex bathrooms wouldn't stand anymore. So I'm curious on your thoughts on that. And then if the court were to go simply on sexual discrimination by gender, whether that argument might cease to hold water anymore. So just interested in your thoughts.
It's a good question. For those of you who don't know, Professor Josh Blackman is my former student, so I'm happy to see him brought up. He's certainly had a very successful career. I think if this is struck down based on sex discrimination as I would want it to be, you could say maybe it would have implications for same-sex bathrooms or for restrictions on bathrooms and locker rooms and the like. But of course, the existing doctrine, which already imposes heightened scrutiny on sex discrimination, already also has implications for those cases. I think as a practical matter, what courts could say on that is that here you can apply the test, which says that it must be substantially related to an important state interest. And in the case of the bathrooms and locker rooms, there is an important state interest in individual privacy. And at least under current technological conditions, it may be that the only way that individual privacy can be protected in that area is to have indeed sex-segregated bathrooms and locker rooms, whereas with respect to opposite sex versus same-sex marriage, there isn't the state interest which the defenders of these laws have so far come up with that can only be promoted in some way by excluding same-sex couples from marriage. I mentioned already in my opening remarks the rationale which comes closest to doing this, the idea that the current marriage laws are intended to promote biological reproduction, and how the current laws are not in fact structured to do that, and how also biological reproduction can still be facilitated if same-sex marriage were also allowed. Opposite-sex couples could engage in biological reproduction and have exactly the same support for it that they have now, even if same-sex couples could also get married.
Professor Bradley?
Nope. Next question.
Okay. We've got another question pending. This looks like our final question, unless someone else rings in by pushing. Oh, we've got two questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
This is Matthew Kazmarek. I serve as Deputy General Counsel at the Liberty Institute, and we filed a brief in this case on behalf of national religious broadcasters. But I'll table for now religious liberty discussions. How would Professor Soman's sex discrimination argument work in light of the Department of Justice, Labor, Education, you know, this administration that is intentionally redefining the word sex to include gender identity? So is that a firm stake in the ground when you see jurists and administration officials redefining the term to include a broader and broader suite of different orientations and identities? How would that hold?
So in this case, there'd be no need to address that issue, because if states can't discriminate based on gender with respect to people who clearly are men or women, it would logically follow that they also can't discriminate, at least in this area, based on gender with respect to people who, in some sense, it's ambiguous whether they're men or women or the like. So if men can marry other men, then a transgender person or person of ambiguous sexuality could also marry a person of either sex, and I think there'd be no significant problem with that. What they're doing does raise some interesting and very difficult issues with respect to things like bathrooms and locker rooms and the like, and I think those questions are indeed genuinely hard, but the Supreme Court doesn't have to address them in this case because there's no comparable issue of privacy like the one that's raised in the locker room situation or the bathroom situation. So as I said before, if a man can marry another man and a woman can marry another woman, then I think there would be no issue in saying that somebody of ambiguous sexuality could marry either a man or a woman. Even if you say, as social conservatives, they would say, well, it's not really ambiguous, that person must be defined as a man or must be defined as a woman. Well, still, if same-sex marriage is permitted, they would still have the full choice of marriage partners without regard to gender.
Now, the federal government regulations that I've seen recently include a definition of gender identity, and it is basically defined as referring to one's internal sense of one's own gender, which may or may not correspond to the sex assigned to a person at birth and may or may not be visible to others. So I think that there's importance to the question raised by Matt Kaczmarek. And it has to do with not so much whether there'll be same-sex marriage, but rather the separate question, although in some ways related, but basically separate question, of what about the next step when persons, transgendered or otherwise, can reestablish or create a new or redefine their own gender. I don't think it's a matter of ambiguity, as Ilya suggests. It's really more a matter of a person's, as they understand themselves to be, really manifesting some underlying truth about themselves, which had been obscured or hidden or in some way not manifest. But the question that arises, and it's already arisen in some of the European cases and probably in the United States and a few jurisdictions, whether or not marriage is defined to include same-sex couples or not, and limited to opposite-sex couples, either way, the question can arise when a partner that is one member of a married couple decides to become a woman or decides to become a man. Think of Bruce Jenner. What about that marriage? And what about the unilateral decision of the transgendered person to change the complexion of a marriage to that between, from, let's say, a man and a woman to that between two women? Now, these are questions that, again, I think are not really teed up in this case, but they will be the questions in tomorrow's cases or next year's cases.
Looks like we've exhausted the questions for now. Let me give each of you a minute to express a final thought. Professor Soman?
Yeah, so a final thought is this, that conservatives for a long time have argued that we should eliminate racial discriminations. We should be tough also on various forms of sex discrimination by government, often regardless of the motive for the discrimination. For example, conservatives, rightly in my view, are suspicious of affirmative action for women or affirmative action for racial minorities, even though it can be claimed that the motivation here is benign. Similarly, I would say that we should be suspicious of the government's sweeping use of sex discrimination in this area, even if at some level they might have benign motivations. I also think that in this area, what we can see is that this is part of the inclusion of gays and lesbians within the mainstream of American and Western society more generally, and overall, that's a good thing. There are certainly other challenges that will arise, including religious liberty challenges, that I think are very important and should be faced, but the way to do that, I think, is to stand up for freedom across the board rather than be in a position where we seem like we were arguing for freedom, but people doubt our motives because they think, well, your only real reason is that you're actually opposed to same-sex marriage or you don't like gays and lesbians. So overall, I think this is a positive development, even though obviously, as with every good, there are some downsides as well, and there's no social change that ever happens that is completely cost-free.
Professor Bradley, final thought.
Yeah, I should like to return to a point that we've mooted earlier in this call, and it has to do with the relationship between, let's call it the reality of marriage, or Professor Soman might refer to it as the philosophy of marriage, and the law of marriage. And if I understand Professor Soman's position in this particular regard correctly, and I think I do, is that we should rather understand the pending cases and the law of marriage generally right now as somehow and here I'm struggling to get the right phrase, and I could be corrected, detached from whatever the truth about marriage is, or it's really not about any particular philosophical view of marriage. I myself doubt that that kind of separation between law and reality is empirically available, but I'm sure it's not what's happening before our eyes. That is most certainly not what Justice Kennedy was talking about in Windsor. It is most certainly not what any of the appellate courts since Windsor have been talking about, and is almost certainly not going to be what the court talks about at the end of June in these cases, for precisely the reason that I suggested earlier, and it's simply this again. In each of these cases, including Windsor, the court talks about a certain extra-legal reality, long-term intimate relationships, as themselves of value. And the language that Justice Kennedy used in Windsor to describe what the law of marriage is doing is precisely honoring, endorsing, approving, and celebrating that relationship. I myself can't think of any more clear way or more transparent way for the court to express its view, which it is their view and will be their view next month or at the end of June, namely that the court is redefining the meaning of marriage to be a long-term stable sexual relationship. That's marriage. That's the reality of it. And the purpose of the law of marriage is to have the political community congratulate, affirm, and celebrate that relationship as a marriage. Now, for the moment, leaving aside the truth of the matter about marriage, my point here is that can't be more clearly, it could not be more clearly a connection, an intimate connection, indeed a union of the reality of marriage and the law of marriage.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you both. This has been a fascinating discussion. To our audience, I'm informed that our call-in system, our Q&A system, might not have been functioning perfectly today. We might have skipped over a couple people, and if you're one of them, I apologize for that. Also to our audience, a reminder about our recap of tomorrow's oral argument in these cases we're talking about today. That will happen here at the same number at 2 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.